Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
All right. I'm going to talk this evening about work I've been conducting collaboratively with Ian Bogost, which includes a book, Racing the Beam, that's just out from MIT Press. And yes, we can even flog it, because and also a book series, Platform Studies. So I want to mention before I get started that, well, for one thing, I'm speaking tomorrow at MIT at Gambit on one of my other interests, interactive fiction. So if you just can't get enough, there's that, or be warned if you want to avoid it. You can also go to my site, nickm.com. And find a lot of fun things, probably some boring things also, which are available there for free. Digital literary work, links to Turbulent-supported project, and all sorts of other goodies. But regarding platform studies, there's this long history of material constraint, creators being influenced by what is available to build with, that exists in human creativity. From the impressions of reed on clay in Sumerian cuneiform, to the mnemonic and metrical device of the Homeric epithet, to the mathematically constrained writing techniques of the Ulipo, to the relationship between the size of silver halide crystals on film emulsion, the light sensitivity of the film, and the optical texture of the photograph that results. The best creators and critics are well aware of how materiality facilitates and constrains certain types of expression and innovation. We believe it's the right time for those interested in human creativity and computing to seriously consider the lowest level of computer systems and to understand their material relationships to culture and creativity. To this end, Platform Studies, the name that Ian Bogost and I give to the practice of exploring the relationships between the hardware and software design of standardized computing platforms and the creative works that have been produced on those platforms. One particular puzzle here that platform studies can almost certainly help to illuminate. The question of why these two games that are shown here differ in so many ways, so fundamentally. Do some of you recognize the one that's on the left, these two screens?
Mm-hmm.
Pong, that Al Alcorn, an engineer for Atari, created in 1972 at Nolan Bushnell's behest. And then on the right, does anyone recognize that one? Hunt the Wumpus. That's a University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth student, Gregory Yob, created at the People's Computer Company in 1973. Now, these games don't just appear to be different, but they really are different in how they represent the underlying world or play space. Pong offers a continuous two-dimensional plane bounded on the top and bottom. Hunt the Wumpus, on the other hand, takes place in this discrete playing field, not the grid that had been used previously in a lot of games, but a dodecahedron. Yet, these games were created within a few miles of each other, Menlo Park and Sunnyvale, within a year of each other. This is contemporary with Cybersyn, 1972 and 73, by two college-educated white guys. So, the question is, what could have contributed to their being so different, despite all the things that they share? The simplest answer probably is that they're made out of different things. Pong is a circuit made of electronic components, while Hunt the Wumpus is a basic program written at a computer terminal. The two different computing systems that these games are built upon provided radically different facilities for representation, for simulating space, and for enabling play. Now, I won't try to explain how any of these differences may follow at this point. I just wanted to note that it would be quite difficult to try to provide an explanation of this sort if we didn't consider the platform level. The creator of a computational work of art could do many different sorts of things. Design circuits and solder chips, for instance, as Al Alcorn did in creating Pong. Or this artist, this author, might write instructions for the integrated circuits and microprocessors of a particular computer, as the programmers of the Atari VCS did. Or such a creator might write software in a high-level programming language. Java here is one example, but another is BASIC, which Gregory Yob used. A person might also program in processing, which is a system that happens to be built on top of Java. When digital media creators choose a platform, they simplify the development and delivery of their work in many ways, but work that is built for a platform is supported and constrained by what that chosen platform can do. Further, platforms are layered, containing one another in many cases. For example, the Intel x86 instruction set architecture has facilitated the creation of many different types of software, including operating systems like Windows 98. Those operating systems in turn offer software development frameworks, such as the C++-based Microsoft Foundation classes. This development platform facilitates the creation of other programs, for example, Flash, which serves in turn as a platform for multimedia creation and coding, being capable of computation as well as animation. A well-defined example of a platform is the 1977 Atari Video Computer System, or Atari 2600 as it was later known, the first popular home video game console and the subject of Racing the Bean. Its hardware design was strongly driven by cost considerations. These led to a number of remarkable decisions, which in turn influenced the way that software had to be written on the machine, which in turn influenced the particular video games created during and after Atari's reign. And the machine influenced creativity in subtle ways, not just because it was underpowered or low res, but because of very specific details of how it was formed and how it functioned, because of particular components that were used. The most important of these certainly was the television interface adapter, or TIA, a custom chip that handled the interface between the processor and the television display. The original name of the Atari 2600 is very appropriate because it is not only a computer system capable of implementing algorithms and executing code, but also very definitely a video computer system intimately tied to the television and its particular workings. The VCS does not have a frame buffer like modern graphics systems or even like contemporary graphics systems or its predecessor, the Fairchild Channel F. It does not set up a region of memory representing the two-dimensional screen, which is then blitted across automatically. Rather, the programmer must use the TIA to construct every scan line of the television picture manually, one by one by one. It would be typical to think of the television picture as an image like a photograph, but the TIA makes its inscription of the VCS display more like writing, to borrow a metaphor from Marshall McLuhan's discussion of the television. Combat, the game included with the Atari 2600 and VCS, and one that was designed while the VCS hardware was also being developed, is practically a pure demonstration of the affordances of the system, showing how its creators imagined that the system might be used. The TIA provides registers for two sprites, each with a corresponding missile. There's a background and a set of low-resolution playfield graphics. The only major graphics facility not seen in combat is the ball, which is used in two-player Pong-style games. The horizontal symmetry that's apparent in combat and other games speaks partly to the system's design as a two-player system, each player with his or her own side, literally leveling the playing field. This practice was facilitated by providing only half as much playfield memory as would have been needed for the whole width of the screen, and then allowing the playfield to be either doubled or mirrored based on a single bit of the TIA's playfield control register. The line-at-a-time nature of the graphics system helps to explain a curious aspect of Pitfall Harry's appearance here in David Crane's Pitfall. The rows of colors that are seen here and on other multicolored VCS sprites appear because there's time for a program to switch colors between lines as it draws the screen, but not generally within one line of the sprite. Besides just being low resolution, Pitfall Harry features this banded color that is not seen on other systems such as the Intellivision and the NES. Stripes similar to those that Pitfall Harry wears are seen here in the sunset of Frostbite. The CRT phosphor's tendency to blend neighboring scan lines together makes the visual effect more subtle than you see here. Pitfall Harry is also drawn out of units similar to pixels that are wider than they are long. These are a feature of the VCS, but also the single line kernel that David Crane used in the game. VCS games such as Combat, which use a two-line kernel, appear to be drawn out of larger square blocks. The fly simulator in the popular Atari original Yar's Revenge has a curious heritage. Howard Scott Warshaw was initially assigned to create a port of an arcade game, Star Castle, which you see here. He convinced Atari management that the port of this very different vector graphics display game would be lousy, and that he had a much better idea, a sort of loose translation, something that was clearly not Star Castle, but would show signs of being inspired by it. Instead of a smoothly rotating ship that could easily be drawn in the vector graphics mode, the fly named Yar is drawn so that it can appear in eight different orientations, up, down, left, right, and the four diagonals. This is suitable for a raster scan display and also fits the joystick controller. The VCS was the first system to use this controller in the home, which can register movement in four directions. Careful attention to the capabilities of the Atari VCS helped Warshaw develop the game successfully, starting with the arcade and ending up in the home, where there was a different computational system and different display hardware. Actually, this is a simulation of a home from Classic Gaming Expo. Another adaptation had a different sort of starting point and ended up helping to create a video game genre. When Warren Robinette set out to create an adaptation of Crowther and Wood's Adventure for the VCS, he faced a peculiar challenge. Adventure that we see here uses only text as input and output, either via teletype or a terminal display. But the Atari VCS has no facility for text. When you create a cartridge, you have to draw each of the numerals that you want to be used in the score display. There's nothing built in. Robinette's solution was to interpret adventure spaces as individual screens on the television with a player cursor that's able to move between them by walking off one side of the screen and onto the opposite side of another. It seems sort of obvious now, but it wasn't at the time. It took him a month to figure out that this could be done on the VCS. Robinette decided to use a scaled-up ball sprite, the size 1x1, single pixel, to represent the player. The sprite becomes the same color as the walls. On later Atari games that were organized differently, such as Raiders of the Lost Ark, adventure games would have high-res player characters. And, of course, on other systems that were all text, some games, such as Rogue, would represent the player with a single character, such as the Atsan. Robinette also adapted the many verbs of adventure into two basic functions, contextual collision and button presses. Collide with a sword to pick it up. Collide the sword with a dragon to slay it. Press the button to drop a held object. Such techniques, some tied rather arbitrarily to the particularities of the VCS, soon became conventions for the graphical adventure genre, which adventure inaugurated. They were adopted and further developed in games such as Ultima, The Legend of Zelda, and on into more contemporary 3D games, which, like adventure, still have virtual worlds larger than a single screen, and still rely on collision detection and button presses to accomplish different actions. The study of computational creativity can take a number of different focuses. I'll briefly distinguish between five of them, focusing on reception, the experience of the user, interface, the user's relationship to the visible, operable part of the system, form and function, which is focusing on the actual operation and behavior of the program, code, focusing on how it is that that program is actually put together, understood by programmers, and written for a machine. And platform, focused on the abstraction layer beneath code. For example, if we were to look at a chess program, at the level of reception operation might be, you know, what people think of the visual display and how they experience playing the program, playing the game of chess with the computer in this way. The interface would, at that level, we'd look at whether it presented a 2D or 3D chess board, or had different skins for the chess pieces, or it, of course, it might not even use any visual display at all. It could speak the moves in chess notation. But the interface wouldn't have anything to do with how the computer played chess or how it implemented the rules of chess. That's the level below, that of form and function. If it didn't get the rules right, and whatever strategies it did use, those would all be located at this level. Beneath that, this chess program was written in a particular way, and if we wanted to study that and examine that, we'd dig into the code level to figure that out. But also, the chess program was written for a particular system. One of them, video chess, was written for the Atari VCS. And we'd look at the platform to try to figure out aspects of how it was that developing that program related to this existing underlying computer system. So frequently when we study things in new media, we look at different levels, multiple levels at once. But in looking at the platform studies concept in the series, we want to endorse that platform layer as a particularly promising underexplored area where new media scholarship should be willing to venture. Our book about the Atari video computer system, Racing the Beam, is the first in the platform studies series. And it shows one possible approach, not the only type of investigation, which uses methods from computing systems and architecture and the material history of the text to try to connect hardware design to cultural practices and the history of video gaming. While other video game consoles may be ripe for a similar type of study, there are many other platforms worth consideration as well, including software platforms for programming, BASIC, Java, Flash, HyperCard, home computers of the late 1970s and 80s, operating systems, and other gaming platforms such as handhelds and arcade systems. Let me note that the 2009 Digital Arts and Culture Conference at the University of California, Irvine, will offer a special opportunity for those undertaking platform studies. There's a theme on software studies and platform studies headed by Noah Ward-Pruin and Jeremy Douglas. The deadline is May 1st, and I wish I had put the URL here. But I do have a URL here. Ian and I welcome those who are interested in joining our investigation of this platform level. You're also welcome to find out more about this platform studies concept and series at the soon-to-be-updated site, platformstudies.org. There's I think everything is accurate except it says our book is forthcoming. We're hoping to augment that site very soon. We'd be glad to discuss authors' thoughts about platforms, work in progress, published work, and proposals for other books in the series. Thank you very much.